Okay. Senator Hoag.
Here.
Senator Burkhardt.
Here.
Senator Cook.
Here.
Senator Dotsenrod.
Here.
Senator Lafine.
Here.
Senator Elke. Senator Sorbag. Representative Hedlund.
Here.
Representative Ballou.
Here.
Representative Belter. Representative Drumdahl. Representative Frostaff.
Here.
Representative Hanson.
Here.
Representative Hattlestead.
Here.
Representative Holman.
Here.
Representative Casper. Representative Meyer.
Here.
Representative Nathy.
Here.
Representative Nelson.
Here.
Representative Owens. Representative Straley.
Here.
That is a quorum, Mr. Chairman, and the absent members notified me they wouldn't be here. And I guess I should point out for anyone unaware, Wes Belter's mother passed away last night, so that was one of his reasons for being absent.
Thank you, John. Did everybody get a chance to review the minutes from our last meeting? And are there any corrections or suggested changes to those minutes?
I move it.
Move approval of the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
We'll go voice vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
You opposed? Thank you. As you look at our agenda, you see that we have a lot of items in the agenda through noon. Our plan is to adjourn at noon. And most of the agenda items are going to be presentations from the tax commissioner and others, and so it'll be for presentation purposes. If we have questions at the end of each presentation, we'll ask them at the end. So we'll start first with a presentation by Mr. Coleman from the Department of Public Instruction on the fiscal effect of providing 65 mils of property tax relief through the allocations of the school district. Mr. Coleman, good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning too. You should have in your handouts two items from the Department of Public Instruction. One is titled Mill Levy Reductions Grant Projections, and the other is a 65 mill levy cap projection. I'm going to start with the mill levy reduction grant projections. This is an update of the projections that I gave you in your October meeting. We revised it based on the 2011 taxable valuations that are currently in, so we, being as we had that data, we updated it, and so I thought that would be a good place to start this presentation and kind of roll through that. In the original projection, we used a 7.7% growth factor and adjusted it for the 20% expected increase in ag property. Since then, this new projection will update that to an 8.28% growth factor, adjusted for a 23% expected increase in ag property valuations. This is for the 2012 taxable year. And then we updated 2011 estimate to what was actual, and that turned out to be 6%. We had used 7.7% on that projection. So the cap rate for the mill levy reduction grants for next school year will be 6%. And what that means is that mill levy reduction grants for any school district can't exceed more than 6% of what they had gotten the previous year. The effect here was we had said it would be 403.4 million, now it's 395.6, so it's roughly 400 million would be the projection to fund the property tax relief grants for the 2013-2015 biennium. If we turn to the first few pages, I guess I'll kind of work from page 7. But this is the projection for the school district grants for next school year. Everything here is all of the data that it takes to calculate the, calculate that amount. You can see the first section, a group of columns there where it starts with total weighted student units, taxable valuation. That's the data that's needed to make the calculation. An important column to note is the combined education mills. That is the mills that school districts were levying in taxable year 2008 for their general fund, tuition, and transportation levies. And that doesn't change. And so this formula is based on what districts were levying in that taxable year. And the basis for the formula is all mills levied over 100 are bought down by the state up to a cap of 75 mills. And there's some minimums and maximums. They can't get less than the grant was the previous year. They can't get more than what the statewide average increase was over the previous year, and I mentioned it was 6% for this upcoming year. So their grants can't grow by that amount. That was something that was put in last session. The mill levy reduction grant rate column there then is the number of mills that school districts are getting, and that's all based on that formula from the 2008 taxable year. So the grant award on the bottom, we expect that these aren't final numbers. There'll be a few minor changes, but they're pretty solid. $169.2 million will be what it takes to fund these grants. If we go to the last page, then we can see the figures that I'm using to project this into the next biennium. I mentioned that it was $395.6 million was the estimate. This current biennium, we think it will be $331.5. We have $341.8 appropriated, so unobligated is $10 million for this current biennium. That's our projection, which that is good news. You can see how I structured this is I used for the 2012 taxable year, we think that growth rate is going to be 1.226, and that factors in that expected 23% increase in ag valuation, and then it goes back. I use 1.08 for the following year, so that's how I come up with those numbers. And then on the bottom right, you can see where it says other inflators. You know, if we miss on these projections, you can kind of see, you know, what kind of range we might have. And it appears to me that for each percentage that we miss on these projections, it'll be $5 to $6 million in actual dollars. So this is basically the formula. So the school districts get a grant in exchange for setting a mill levy rate, general fund mill levy rate of 110 mills or less. And there's some exceptions to that. If they had a higher one and the voters had granted them approval, that was grandfathered in. They all have to go to a vote of the people by 2015 to have that extended for 10 years at a time. And we currently have, I think, 9 school districts that are over the 110 mills. 49 are at the 110. We have 58 school districts between 100 and 110, and 63 would be below 100, and that accounts for our 179 operating school districts.
Questions for Mr. Coleman? Mr. Coleman, I noticed that your projections versus your actual have been increasing in accuracy. Is that because you're developing a little more confidence in the formulas that you're using, or?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't know. I guess we're getting better. You know, as we move forward, we get closer. You know, when we start, we're like 3 years out. And now we've got 1 year newer data actual, so it does allow us a little more precision in our estimates. The farther you go out, the wider your projection error usually is.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coleman, you've got a note here, an asterisk about the expected ag cap rate, the adjustment for anticipated 23% increase in ag land values. And I'm not sure if I really understand how that affects the numbers. I understand you've got biennium totals, 395, there's an increase of 64. I don't know if I really understand how these numbers have been affected by that ag land value increase.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotsenrod, when you break that down, you know, we have a variety of taxable property out there, and so the 23% is related just to the ag property component of that. But when you merge that into total taxable valuation, that the overall impact is close to 4%. Just that big bump for that 1 year for that projected increase in ag value affects the statewide average about another 4%. So all other classes of property, we're using 8, and then because of this big jump in ag valuation, that affected that state average, increased the state average another 4%. And that is expected to be just for this 2012 taxable year only. And that's my understanding of how that goes.
Further questions for Mr. Coleman? Representative Blue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Jay, do you have any idea what it would cost if the legislature bought all the mills down for education?
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Blue, I can give you kind of a ballpark. It would probably be, you know, $300 million annually.
$300 million annually.
You know, that would be, you know, ballpark guess.
Thank you.
Seems light. Representative Naisby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Jerry, would that be over and above the $395 we have here? So, rather than $695 to buy them all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Naisby, I believe that would be true, yes. You could, one place you can look, if you're familiar with our finance facts document, there's statewide summaries are in Section A of that document, and it will break down, at least on that Section A, the general fund mill levy collections for school districts. They will have building levies, too, that you might have to account for, but you could get a ballpark figure from that schedule.
Go ahead.
Jerry, could you send that or that page of that document to the committee so we could all take a look at that?
Mr. Chairman, I could do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Would you present it to Mr. Walstead and move it?
Mr. Walstead knows where to find that information.
Yeah, I could actually do that all by myself.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Coleman? If not, thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, you had requested a look at a 65 mil cap adjustment in the formula. So if I could run through that quickly.
Yes.
That is this one that's titled the 65 mil levy cap projection.
Okay.
And basically, it's I'm using the same model that built the first projection. The only thing I changed was I dropped the cap from 75 mils to 65 mils. And it was necessary to remove the minimum in the first year because it's taking money out of that formula. But otherwise, I left all of the parameters the same. I just adjusted the state buy-down for mils from a cap of 75 mils down to 65 mils. And let me get into the right one here. So what that does is it reduces the cost. It takes the cost down to, I'm working from the last page here, the cost down to a projected $353 million. So if you compare it to expenditures, it would require a $22 million increase from the previous biennium. But basically, if you look at the projected cost for the 75, our current program is close to $400 million, so it's about a $42 million shift in taxes is what it would be. be the bottom line. It would, at the same time that we decreased the state buy-down 10 mils, the request was to increase the mill levy cap another 10 mils from 110 to 120. So it would be a shift of 42 million from state sources to local property tax sources.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, unless there's other questions, that concludes my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Next, we're going to hear from Ms. Marcy Dickerson of the Tax Department. And she is going to talk to us about statewide taxable valuation growth.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Hogue, members of the Taxation Committee, I am Marcy Dickerson, State Supervisor of Assessments and Director of the Property Tax Division for the Office of State Tax Commissioner. I am here today to provide information on estimated statewide taxable value growth for all property classifications for 2012 and 2013. Estimated shifting of tax burden and property tax relief among property classifications, and effective tax rates for agricultural property. To estimate changes in taxable values of the various property classifications, I looked at a 10-year history of each class. I also considered the significant increase in the NDSU calculated average agricultural value per acre for 2012, and the decision of the State Board of Equalization to broaden the tolerance for 2012 assessments to 90% to 100% of true and full value for all locally assessed property. Tolerance has been from 95% to 100% for 2009, 2010, and 2011. Prior to the 2009 enactment of Section 5713.04.1, which prohibits the State Board of Equalization from approving assessments of residential and commercial property that exceed true and full value as determined by the sales ratio study, the allowed tolerance was 95 to 105% of true and full value for agricultural, residential, and commercial property. Then you see a chart with estimated changes in taxable value. We start with the actual taxable value in 2011 for ag land, residential property, commercial property, and centrally assessed property, which is basically railroads and utilities. Estimated 2012 taxable value. Next column is estimated changes, taxable value changes. And the final column is estimate percent change from 2011 to 2012. You see in agricultural land, I've come up with an estimate of 22.73%. That's pretty close to what Jerry has in 23%. So it's always nice to have an agreement between us when we start from different sources. Residential property, we're estimating 7.75% for 2011 to 2012. Commercial, 6.61%. And centrally assessed, 15%. That is basically due to estimated increase in pipeline property, which is centrally assessed, and also wind farm property, which is centrally assessed. At the bottom of the page, there's the estimated increase from the estimated 2012 value to 2013, figured the same way. Agricultural land, I'm looking at about 6.24%, everything else remaining the same. Residential property, again, 7.75. Commercial, again, 6.61. And centrally assessed, 15%. So overall, we're looking at, for the statewide estimated change, 12.27% in 2012 and 7.66% in 2013. I believe that because of the 29% increase in NDSU calculated average agricultural value per acre for 2012, counties will take advantage of the State Board of Equalization's broadened tolerance and set their agricultural valuations nearer 90% than 100% of average agricultural value. That is why I am estimating a 22.73% increase in agricultural land value statewide, approximately 22% less than the actual statewide increase. You asked to see an estimate of the shift of property tax burden among property classifications, and that's what the next chart shows. I was actually kind of surprised to find out the shift wasn't as great as I had originally considered. We start here with 2010 values to 2011 values, then I averaged those 2 years to have a base to start the change from. The average 2 years is just a little less than halfway down the chart. You see statewide, the average percentage for 2 years was 27.87% for ag value. For residential, they had 41.47%. Commercial was 22.62%. Centrally assessed, 8.04%, equaling the total valuation percentages in the state. From the estimated taxable value, the change to 2012, and that highlighting got a little bit dark, but we see a 9.33% change. But basically, I should explain the 27 to 30%, 27 two-year average to 30.47%. That is a 9.33% change in agricultural value because basically of that cap rate change. In a residential, it would be a 4.68% loss in percentage. Commercial taxable value would decrease 5%. Statewide, again, the centrally assessed would increase 5.85%. Excuse me. So really, the changes in the shift of the property, the major change would be that 9% increase in the ag value. And the others, we have a minus 4.68, a minus 5, a plus 5.85. So they are not as great as I thought. The ag change is the one that's a little more significant. To estimate the shift of the tax burden among property classifications, I first compared estimated 2012 taxable valuations to the two-year average of 2010 and 2011 taxable valuations. And again, the highlighted row above shows the changes in percent of total taxable valuations for each class of property from the two-year average to 2012. And there again, we're going through the numbers that I just mentioned to you. Assuming no change in mill rates, which was in the request, which is unlikely, you know, mill rates are going to change, no question. Taxes in the tax burden would follow those percentages. And for 2013, the change in tax burden is slight, except for a 6.82% increase for centrally assessed property. Again, estimating increased pipeline and wind power construction. The shift to property tax relief among property classifications follows the shift in tax burden because the current property tax relief program provides similar relief to all properties in the same school district. For most schools, that is 75 mills. The percentage of property tax relief provided by 75 mills varies depending on how many mills other political subdivisions levy. Property that makes payment in lieu of taxes and receives property tax relief is not included in these taxable valuation figures, but receives a relatively small portion of total property tax relief. In comparison of market value versus agricultural value of agricultural property, the most recent data available comparing agricultural value per acre to market value is from the 2011 sales ratio study and represents 2010 sales. Two counties, Morton and Renville, reported no sales of agricultural land. Median ratios for the other 51 counties range from 16.5% in Ransom County to 64.9% in Cavalier County. The arithmetic mean for the 51 reporting counties is 37.8%. Actual 2011 property taxes levied on agricultural property were $168,480,607 for the 51 counties for which sales were reported. If the same mill rates are applied to estimated market value, approximately $471,300,000, or nearly 180% more, is raised in the 51 counties. Mill rates may be reduced because of additional value. Actual 2011 effective tax rate for agricultural land using agricultural value averaged 1.24% for 51 counties. Effective tax rate for agricultural land using market value would average 0.46%. That concludes my prepared testimony, but I'll be happy to try to answer any questions. There are a couple of charts on the back. If you want me to go through them and explain them, I can do that. The headings, I think, are pretty self-explanatory.
Please do so, Ms. Dickerson.
Okay, the first one has to do with the taxable values of rural ag land, urban ag land, total ag value. We did it that way because that's the way it comes out of our statistical report, but you see in about the middle of the page the total ag value and the rural ag value taxes and the urban ag value taxes and total ag taxes. So your important columns there are the total ag value and the total ag taxes. And on the next page, we have the ag land median ratio, which I referred to, which came out statewide to 37.8. Then we estimate the ag taxable value at market value, and then estimate the taxes at market value. And that's the last two columns are the effective tax rates that I referred to in my testimony that are generated from using estimated market value versus the agricultural value that's currently in law.
Representative Blue had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the first page of your testimony, Marcy, about three quarters of the way down, you reference NDCC 571304.1, and two lines below that you say, in commercial property that exceeds true full value as determined by the sales ratio study. What's the sales ratio study?
The sales ratio study is a statewide study that we conduct every year that looks at properties that have sold and the price at which they sold. Compare that to the value that the assessor has put on those properties. That will show either that the properties are being overassessed, properly assessed, or underassessed. But we do that with all properties that have sold that meet the criteria for the study. It has to be an arm's length transaction. There can't be father-son transactions and what have you. But any acceptable sale is used in that study. And that shows us by individual counties and by the major cities how good the assessments are in relation to being close to the actual property value when it's sold.
Senator Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dickerson, on page three, about halfway down, and I know you talked about this twice, but can you explain to me or simplify what arithmetic means for the 51 reporting counties
at 37.8%? What was that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burkhardt, that is when I add up all of the percentages for the whole 51 counties that reported, and then divide that number by 51.
Thank you.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, Marcy, on page one, your chart at the bottom, estimated percent of change, I look at residential and commercial, 7.75, 6.61, I assume that's a statewide average.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, that's correct, that's all statewide average.
Any idea what the span of that average is around the state? Do we have residential property in some points of the state that are over 10% and some as low as, any idea?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, I'm sure there are. I have that upstairs, or it's probably included in the data I extrapolated this from. But certainly values have been increasing where there is more demand. I mean, the western part of the state is probably the biggest example. But even the Bismarck Landale area, there's enough spillover from the oil country where some people are trying to move out of the homes they've lived in for years because of the oil exploration, and now they're coming to Bismarck Mandan. So valuations in popular areas certainly are going up faster than others.
Mr. Chairman, two more, if I can. Is it safe for me to assume that the 22.73% is relatively constant from county to county?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, pretty much so. We have a list of the counties and the changes from county to county. They're all about the same percent. But this 22.73%, I have factored in the fact that I suspect the counties are going to head for that 90% tolerance that the State Board of Equalization has now approved. Because the total statewide change is 29%, and most of those range between maybe 27 to 31, 32% by individual counties. But I factored in that I think the counties are going to go to the low end of that tolerance range. But if I'm wrong, it'll be higher.
And then the last one, Mr. Chairman, Marcy, Morton County did not report any sales. Is that because there wasn't any, or is it because they just didn't have to do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, they have to do it just like anyone else, but they did not report any agricultural sales. They did report other sales, but they did not report any sales of ag property. At least no usable sales. They might have reported some that for some reason were like a family transaction or something, but they did not report any usable sales.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcy, can you predict what would happen to ag property taxes should the interest rates move to more historic averages?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hedlund, you know, there's 10 years figured in those averages, and you throw out a high and a low. So at this point, 1 year's change isn't as big a deal as it was, you know, because of the change in the cap rate. But I suspect that if the cap rates go back to, or remain at the actual cap rate, which it was at this year, it will probably stay about the same as it is for this year. And hopefully interest rates will go up a little, and then that would increase the cap rate and decrease the taxes.
I wasn't asking for a rate increase, by the way.
Well, I am. My CDs are giving me 20%. 0.20%. 20%, I take.
Now, further questions for Ms. Dickerson? If not, thank you. Okay. Next item on the agenda, we're going to hear from Mr. Walstead about a bill draft relating to property tax relief through a residential property tax credit. Mr. Walstead.
Chairman and committee members, the bill draft at this juncture is a bill that was reviewed and discussed by the committee at the last committee meeting, and I am distributing it now just as a refresher because Ms. Strombeck was asked to do some estimates to fill in an amount for the homestead credit that, wait a minute, I'm looking at the wrong bill here. Ah, here we go. The bill, by the way, 13.0017, I also distributed 13.0018, and that is just the bill that would extend the current relief method. The 17 is the one that deals with farm residences and a residential property tax credit that looks a lot like a homestead credit. And in the draft on page 4, there's a blank as to what number of dollars of taxable valuation this credit would cover. And Ms. Strombeck was asked to do an analysis at various levels of the number that would go in that blank and what the cost of that would be, because on page 7 of the bill draft, there's also a blank on the amount of money that would need to be appropriated to fund that relief. So, it's just a refresher. I can address any questions the committee might have before Ms. Strombeck talks about filling in the blanks.
Questions for John before Ms. Strombeck fills in the blanks? Why don't we have Ms. Strombeck come up then and...
That is not Ms. Strombeck.
Oh. The 1010 agenda item and the 1025, so we'll go to additional bill drafts. The 1040 agenda item related to eliminating the Montana residents' sales tax exemption and the Canadian tax refund. Mr. Walstead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, at the previous committee meeting, a request was made to consider bill drafts for the purposes just mentioned. The drafts are before you, 13.0048 and 13.0049. 48 relates to Montana sales tax. Doesn't mention Montana specifically, but it's the only adjoining state that doesn't have a sales tax. Now, the first section of the bill is just to clean up a reference to a subsection, and the reason is that that subsection is repealed in sub 2. And that repeal of subsection 12, that is the Montana resident sales tax exemption. So, pretty short and sweet bill draft. The other bill draft is also a repeal. Canadian residents used to get an exemption that was changed to a refund provision a number of years ago, so it is now a freestanding section, and the bill repeals that section, which allows Canadian residents to obtain a sales tax refund in North Dakota. Also pretty short and sweet. And then I gave you a copy from the Red Book of the estimated effects of sales and use tax exemptions, and I should have marked them. The Montana resident exemption and the Canadian resident refund are listed on here, and now I'm having trouble locating them. There they are. They are both in the range of $1 to $2 million a biennium each. So,
Mr. Walstead, maybe you could refresh our memory on the policy considerations behind the existing exemptions for Montanans and Canadians.
Well, Mr. Chairman, been in place for quite a long time. Merchants, retailers, I think, favor them. Those near the Montana border observed that North Dakota residents could go over and across the border and buy things in Montana without paying a sales tax, bring them back to North Dakota and avoid the sales tax, and therefore avoid going into that retailer's establishment in North Dakota. I think times have probably changed now with the oil industry activity in the West, and I discussed a little bit with Miles Vosburg concern, and I don't know to what extent it applies, but if you are out in the oil fields working on oil rigs, and you and a Montana business are both runoff in Williston and using it in North Dakota, the North Dakota business is at a disadvantage because the Montana resident gets an exemption. If they're doing business in Montana, the North Dakota resident is still at a disadvantage. He's got to pay tax on the materials, take them to Montana and use them. And the Montana business, buying them also in Williston and taking them to Montana, pays no tax. So I don't know to what extent that is a problem, but I think times have changed since that exemption was put in place. And with regard to Canadian residents, I think we got information at the last committee meeting that North Dakota is really the only state along the Canadian border from coast to coast that allows Canadian residents a sales tax refund. The merchants along the northern border, I think, have for years and years supported that. And once again, maybe circumstances have changed because that support was pretty strong back when a Canadian dollar was worth 65 cents.
Senator Sorbuck.
Mr. Chairman, and this is more of a comment than a statement, but a little bit to Mr. Wells. After we talked about this last committee, I did talk to some of our retailers in the Fargo area. And their comment, first of all, and these are some that own malls and stuff, but they don't really know what the amount is because of the refund nature of it. They don't know who's applying or not. But what they ask that the committee keep in consideration is that we live next to a state that clothing is sales tax free. And the main comment that they gave is that the Canadian shopper is very price sensitive. And they're concerned, and they'll come and buy in large volumes. You know, I mean, they'll load up a vehicle and they'll buy a lot of dollars. So it gets to the point it can be real dollars, and a lot of real dollars. Then they feel that it could affect their sales, going even justifying with the price of gas to go to the cities or not. But again, they don't really know, because they don't track the Canadian sales, because it's a refund, it's not exemption giving on the site. But it was just a concern. They think it's beneficial to the, and I'm talking about the Red River Valley corridor, and I know Senator Lafine and his home area, both our areas are very dependent on retail sales to the Canadian market. So I would just ask that that be considered in everybody's thinking as this goes along.
Thank you. Any further discussion on these two bill drafts? Representative Halstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Visited with the local Chamber of Commerce, asked them to do a quick business survey, and an unofficial survey, and the results came back about 50-50. But a couple of Montana residents sent a letter along as well. The newspaper picked it up, and they were not complimentary of North Dakota politicians. They suggested you don't screw over your friends, that we worked long and hard to build up a relationship, and now you're going to. So the Montana people were adamant that the only reason we do business with you is because. And so two businesses said they figured they'd lose a third to a half of their business. They do that much with Montana customers. So they would be adamantly opposed to eliminating the exemption. Those that favor it cited the abuse that you mentioned, that contractors buy North Dakota product, and some of them are even using the product in North Dakota. Take the Montana exemption and use the product in North Dakota, which obviously is illegal, but they're doing it anyhow, no enforcement.
Thank you. Further comments or questions for Mr. Wallstead about the two bill drafts for the Montana sales tax exemption and the Canadian? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wallstead, what Representative Halstead just commented on, would you explain that more? If you have If you use the Montana exemption, does that product have to be used in Montana? Well, how does that come into play? Or if or doesn't it? If what's the law on that?
I don't see. I think Mr. Rosberg would be better able to answer your question.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Miles Rosberg, director of at the tax department. The, you know, under the law for the Montana exemption, it says the person needs to come to the state of North Dakota specifically to make a purchase. And so those that are living here or that are here for some other reason, they're a contractor doing a job, they're a student maybe at a college here, would not be eligible for the exemption. It does not specifically have to be used in Montana, though. There isn't anything in the exemption that would say that.
To just follow up, then if, say you're an oil company, and the only place that has pipe is in Montana, you have to pay sales tax on that and admit it to North, you're bringing it back to North Dakota to use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Myers, if you're asking if someone from Montana comes to North Dakota to make the purchase but still uses it in North Dakota?
Yes, correct.
That representative would be subject to tax.
Further questions for Mr. Vosburg? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's say we're out in the oil field and we've got some suppliers move over to Montana because of the sales tax exemption. Do we have any real way to track suppliers coming into the state that we see that those companies are paying use tax on them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, audit would pretty much be the only way. You know, we do audit a number of companies all over the state, and so we would look at their purchases and their records of what they're bringing in to the state and what they're using here. That would be the main way of detecting that type of activity.
Senator Cook.
Miles, I just got to make sure that I understand Representative Myers' question and the way I thought I did in your answer. If a Montana company is doing work in North Dakota and they buy pipe in North Dakota, they do not have to pay sales tax.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, no. If a Montana company is doing work, doing jobs in North Dakota, and they're purchasing here, they would be required to pay the tax.
I thought I heard you say earlier there's no requirement in the law that they use it in Montana.
Senator Cook, that was probably, there's no requirement that they specifically use it in Montana, but it can't be used for a job here in North Dakota. So in other words, they could go to South Dakota with it, they could go to Wyoming with it, and not have to pay tax. But if it's used here in North Dakota, then they would have to pay the tax.
And then how do we know at the time of purchase, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Miles, how do we know at the time of purchase whether they're going to use it in North Dakota or Montana?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, we would have to rely on the exemption certificate that the purchaser signs, and they basically certify that they're taking it for use outside of the state. You know, then we could follow up with audit, but otherwise, that's true. I mean, we don't know if they sign the certificate, but then they still use it in North Dakota. We may not know that unless we do an audit of that company.
Do you detect that? Mr. Miles, do you detect that in an audit? Have you? You got a history out there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, we have found some instances. More likely it's individuals and businesses. For example, we had an individual that was building a home in Moorhead, and we're buying materials in Minnesota, and this individual's father was from Montana. They were using the certificate to buy materials, and we did find that through audit and investigation and bill the tax back.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Miles, I have one other question and then two other questions. A North Dakota company that goes over to Montana and buys pipe is not going to pay sales tax at time of the purchase. They bring it back to North Dakota and use it in North Dakota. They're required by law to pay a use tax, correct?
Chairman, Senator Cook, that is correct.
And you will find that easier in an audit than you would probably identify whether it's used in North Dakota or not from a Montana company.
Correct.
And then the last thing is, I've heard a lot over the years now, the last few years since the boom in Williston, about not pipe or oil-related company, but building materials, insulation, etc. Tremendous amount of out-of-state companies doing work in Williston who are bringing with them the product and using it in Williston, installing it in Williston, and not paying the tax. Have you done many audits out there to detect to what degree that is a problem? Are you seeing any, is any history there that you have?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cook, we are doing audits, and in addition, you may be familiar with the compliance project that the tax department did with some of the other agencies to see if contractors were licensed, paying tax, and so on. We have found materials coming in from Montana that's being used in construction projects, yes.
That leads to one more, if I may, and then I'll shut up.
Cook, I'm glad to know your lawyer hasn't put a gag on you, because...
And Mr. Chairman, I am sure glad to know you are so concerned. More so probably than I am. I forgot my question now. Thanks a lot. Gag order worked. I did forget it. Tough to get to be 60. I'll think about it.
Okay. Miles, could you stand by? Well, Senator Cook. Any further questions? Senator Cook.
Oh, yeah, think about it. What's the disincentive of them for trying to avoid the tax? Penalty and interest, how severe is it? I mean, I'm an out-of-state company. I'm buying product, not paying the tax, using it in North Dakota. Audit comes along. I mean, I've been audited, but is there a stiffer penalty or for any of this type of tax evasion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, the penalties would be the same and the interest. And so 5% penalty for failure to pay and report and 1% interest from the time the tax was due, 1% per month. From the time the tax was due to when it's paid.
Okay. Thank you, Miles. Any further discussion or questions about the two bill drafts? If not, let's go on to the next agenda item, which is the 1050 agenda item on a bill draft to address the a disclosure requirement for building authorities and political subdivisions on their bond debt. Mr. Wellstead.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there was a bill draft that the committee looked at the last meeting that provided for filing of reports by building authorities with regard to indebtedness they incur to build a building for use by a political subdivision under a lease arrangement. The committee suggested that the bill draft should be expanded to require a central gathering point for all information on indebtedness of political subdivisions and building authorities. So the draft was expanded. In the first draft, I had plugged in the Securities Commissioner as the filing point for the reports, and that was under the assumption that when those bond issues are done, there is a registration requirement with the Securities Commissioner. But after talking to the Commissioner, I found that there is no reporting requirement. They really don't have anything to do with bonds issued for instead of securities commissioners. So now you see some blanks on the question of what agency would be the central source for these reports. Those are the most significant changes in the draft from what the committee looked at before, and I can address any questions or comments.
Any questions for Mr. Wallstedt on this bill draft? Senator Sorbug.
Mr. Chairman, John, just a question on line 11 on the first page. We're looking at 130015, correct?
Yes.
It says before the issuance. Is there a reason it's before or not after? Because this is sort of like as a clearinghouse for a report of how much debt it is. There's no approval process, my understanding, going in here. It's just to be able to track.
That's correct, and that's a good question. The draft that we looked at the previous meeting said after, and I changed it to before, thinking that maybe it's necessary to make it a precondition for the issuance of bonds that the report be filed somewhere, because once the bonds have been issued, then how do you force the reports to come in? I don't know, but it's a discussion issue.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up, but there is no intent, the way I'm reading this, of any enforcement that they're borrowing too much. This is solely for reporting is all the intent of this is.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator.
I don't think this bill would change business as we know it one bit. I would consider this bill simply to be a transparency bill. I think it's a very important thing that we all do know, and that is the degree of bonded debt that is general obligation debt and imposed or could be imposed on the taxpayers. I think there's a lot of political subdivisions out there that are issuing it, and I'm quite frankly kind of shocked that we have never gone down this road before and created some central depository for this information, so you can find out, especially when we got constitutional limits on how much debt can be imposed on a taxpayer. So I don't know, how do we go about filling the blank, Mr. Wallstedt? Have you had any conversations with other places that would be the right place to deposit this information? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, no, I haven't. I didn't know if I should be the guy to go out arm twisting for somebody to take the job on, so I thought I'd leave it blank and see what the committee suggests. I can certainly make inquiries at places where the committee thinks I should discuss it.
Well, I don't see anybody from the Bank of North Dakota here, so maybe we could fill them in. John, I had a question. Now, would this include the language political subdivisions, apolitical subdivisions, building authority, or other entity? Would this include higher education institutions?
Let's see. Political subdivisions, or other entity. I hadn't thought about it when I was writing it, but other entity is pretty wide open. I intended that it was directed to political subdivisions.
Okay. What's the committee's thought? I mean, we do have a lot of institutions that issue bonds to pay for particularly athletic programs and projects. Senator Cook, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I don't see this as a bill that will change business as we know it. As I said, it's simply a transparency issue.
I don't know what's wrong with higher ed being transparent on the issuing of bonds either. I don't know if they'd object to it. It'd be interesting to see. I would hope it would include higher ed.
Sure. Further discussion on this bill draft? Senator Sorba.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with Senator Cook, too. I agree that we need it for transparency. My only concern was with that word of before and after. And the reason is, since I serve on the Park Commission in Fargo, I'm sensitive to that. And when we issue a bond, we don't know. They're put up for sale the morning of our board meetings. And then we either approve them or don't approve them, depending on what the sale value we come in. So you, if you had to do it before that issuing, I don't know if they're, and that would be my only thing. And John could be better at, maybe that's nothing that falls in. Maybe this term means nothing. But to go back to after, because so it's solely for reporting and transparency of what debt that entity has. It's not approval. But I'll leave that up to, you know, the attorneys. But I guess I'd rather see it after, unless you, the issuing of the bond.
That's a good point, Senator. I think it would be worthwhile for us to ask some of our bond counsel around the state to take a look at this to make sure that we're not messing up the bond issuance process, or to make some clarifying language that makes it clear that this is a reporting mechanism and is not part of the bond issuance process. Senator Cook.
One other question. I'm trying to read this bill draft real fast to see if I can get my own answer. But John, this requires any future bonds. Is there anything in this bill that would require all existing bonds, current bonds, to be reported somewhere?
Yeah, very good point.
Okay.
Senator Cook, Mr. Chairman, in the application section, I added some language there in this draft to clarify that. So any bond issue after July 31, 2013, this applies. And any bond issue that occurred before August 1, 2013, that has not been retired as of that date. So if there's still an outstanding indebtedness, when this takes effect, a report would have to be filed on how much debt is out there, when it's expected to be retired, and that kind of thing. So yeah, existing bond issues would be subject to this unless they've been retired.
Okay. Senator Cook.
Just one other thought comes to me. Bank of North Dakota, that thought was in my mind also, but I'm wondering if the auditor's office might be worth a conversation with the auditor's office.
No, they're not here either, so we could put them in.
As Senator Holmberg used to say during redistricting, if you're not in the room, you'll be on the menu.
Okay, any more discussion on this item? John, you think you got enough guidance to come back with another draft of this one?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, I guess on the issue of higher ed or whoever also being included, you know, we've got the words in here, other entity, that are pretty unclear. So if the committee would like it to cover those entities, then I should probably write it so it's clear one way or the other and not a guessing game. Maybe what I need to do though is a little more research and find out, like higher ed and entities like that, if there is some place where there is already information on those.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess with the past history of higher ed lately, I'd like to see it black and white and have higher ed specifically stated in there, so we're not sitting here messing around with these guys as far as interpretation and what applies to who. Just my thoughts.
Yeah, and I think that's Representative Nathy is echoing what I think the majority of the committee would like to see. I think that should be spelled out, and you know, since it is just a reporting requirement, a transparency requirement that Senator Cook called it, I don't think it hurts to put it all in one centralized spot where we know what the outstanding debt is. Further discussion on the reporting requirement for bond debt. If not, we'll go on to the next agenda item, which is a memorandum from the tax department relative to the authority of the Board of Equalization regarding local property tax exemption decisions. Do we have anybody from the...
Well, actually, that's me.
Okay.
Mr. Rose from the tax department prepared the memorandum that you have in front of you. Up at the top it says Memorandum for Interim Taxation Committee. Mr. Rouse has been deployed for active military duty today, so he's unable to be here. But I think it's easy enough to see from his memorandum. The question was, does the State Board of Equalization have any authority to address an appeal and take action with regard to a property tax exemption that has been granted that was discretionary with, in this case, the city government? And Mr. Rouse's response in the memorandum, I think you can see there is apparently nothing in law. The State Board of Equalization concluded that it did not have statutory authority to reverse local governing body determinations about a new or expanding business incentive. And then he cites some language that it's the municipality's determination that controls, and then a question was raised by the committee about the recent legislation on the authority of the State Board of Equalization, Senate Bill 2294. Did that expand State Board of Equalization authority in these circumstances? And the board's and Mr. Rouse's conclusion was that that legislation did not give the board authority to hear an appeal and reverse a decision of a city. Now, unless there's some questions about the memo, I also have distributed to you copies of Senate Bill 2294, the bill that the committee brought up for Mr. Rouse's consideration. And just paging to page 3 of the draft. Down at the bottom, an amendment was made to the State Board of Equalization General Powers and Duties section of code, and the underscored language there is what was added. So now, the old law said that the board has power to equalize assessment of property. And now it says the board has power to equalize the assessment, classification, and exemption status of property between assessment districts. And I think that language, and over on page 4, just past the midpoint of the page, subsection 4, equalize the classification and taxable status of real property. And then further down in that same sub 4, in the case of an appeal, the owner of the property must establish to the satisfaction of the board that the owner of the property had first appealed the classification of taxable status determination to the local board. So to trigger this board's authority here, apparently the appeal has to come from the property owner, and the property owner has to have gone through those other levels of appeal. In the circumstance here, the owner was perfectly satisfied with having an exemption. It was another taxpayer who raised the issue that, hey, this doesn't look right to me. So yeah, I'm not sure if there's a problem in the way this is worded or not, or even if the committee thinks that the State Board of Equalization should be getting involved in second-guessing local decisions on exemptions, but this is what I have found.
Okay. Questions? Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, certainly with the amount of increase we've seen in taxable value and property taxes collected, I think it's necessary for all political subdivisions to find a mechanism or a way to establish fairness across all property. And I don't think that it's fair to all property taxpayers if a certain entity is given an exemption from property tax on the basis of providing some type of service. I think that they should fully be responsible to carry out that service in order to receive the exemption. And I don't think that there's anything currently in this legislation that, well, we're being told there's nothing that gives the Board of Equalization that authority. So it's my opinion that we do need a bill draft to give them that authority, or at least to give them authority to make the political subdivision address the issue, just for the fairness of all property taxpayers within the subdivision.
Point of clarification, Mr. Walstead, is the current state of the law that the, let's say, the local governing body, once they grant an exemption, you know, for whatever the law allows, is there nothing in the law that gives them the right to revisit that because the property owner isn't putting the property to the exempted use?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. There is nothing in statute that says they can do that. There are some statutory provisions that if the property ownership changes, if the business is relocated, I think there's one other instance, but and the Jamestown City Attorney pointed out in an opinion that was in the material we looked at last meeting, that there's nothing in statute that says a city that has granted one of these new business exemptions can take it away if it finds that it got bad information up front, or circumstances have changed, or the project is bigger than anticipated, or whatever. There's nothing in law, and that's kind of a lead-in to the next bill draft for consideration. That should we go ahead to that, or other questions? Bill draft was prepared. The number on this one is 13.0052, and as we were just discussing, it was pointed out by the city attorney for the city of Jamestown that current law really doesn't allow a city or county governing board issuing an exemption for a new business, that if they find that there hasn't been follow through with what they expected was going to happen, that they can go back and pull back all or part of that exemption. So the bill draft on page 3 adds some new language and says the governing body, and it says municipality, and in this chapter, municipality is defined as the city for property inside city limits, or the county for property outside city limits. Before the beginning of the tax year for which an exemption that has previously been approved It can be revoked or reduced if the governing body finds, and then there's a list. And admittedly, I kind of made up what's on the list here. The committee may want to consider what the proper criteria should be. But one is, information was provided by the project operator during the negotiation and deliberation has proven to be inaccurate or untrue. The use of the property by the operator does not comply with the reasonable expectations of the governing body at the time the exemption was approved. The third one, property has been improved to a substantially greater extent than the governing body reasonably anticipated at the time the exemption was approved. Or change of ownership. And that's really all this adds to the law. Now, I've also distributed a copy of a code section. And this is a section of current law that has some provisions in it. I could have chosen to amend this section instead of inserting the language where it is in the bill draft, but personally, I think this section is so badly drafted, and it wasn't me, that, well, in the first sentence, okay, if the capital investment in the building structures, et cetera, exceeds the original investment because expansion of the project increased the investment in the project by more than 20%, the operator has to reapply, okay? Who is going to know that the investment went up by more than 20%? Only the operator. And he ain't going to go say anything because then he's got to reapply, so... there are some things in here about moving the business to a new location, and I didn't include that here, and maybe that is one of the things that should be on the list. And then, just plugged in the middle of this section, the State Board of Equalization has authority to grant an income tax exemption for one of these projects, and in the middle here is, business relocation has no effect on the income tax exemption if the operator satisfies the Board of Equalization that the nature of the business hasn't been changed. I didn't address that in the bill draft because the income tax exemption is a separate issue. And then it applies only to the operator to whom it was granted, so a change of operator would require reapplication. So anyway, like I said, this section doesn't look practical and workable, so I left it alone and just thought I'd point it out to the committee and see what you would prefer to do.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, I can't help but think that all of these various things we're discussing right now are symptoms of a problem and not the problem themselves. And I think the problem is property tax exemptions as a whole, not that they should no longer be a tool in a city or county's toolbox for economic development, but because I think they are being probably abused. And I think that it is people's perception of the property tax exemptions and to the degree that which they are being used or not used properly in their minds is a cause for a lot of people to say that property taxes are unfair. And I think that if we're ever going to solve the problem, we've got to start right with the whole issue of the ability to issue property tax exemptions. And I think we need to narrow the scope. And I think that there's some places out there that are being used very effectively. I think there's places where they are truly being abused. And so, you know, at some point, we got to get away from the symptoms and go at the problem.
Thank you, Senator Cook. Senator Levine.
Mr. Chairman, I would echo exactly what Senator Cook said. It seems like these property tax exemptions mostly would be sort of a business incentive
to get something done. And if ever there was a time in North Dakota's history when we maybe don't need that right now, today would be that time.
Yeah, I think one comment I would have, Mr. Walsted, as well, is that we should vet this through the state state chamber and the Economic Development Department, because oftentimes these deals get struck as part of a package between the county or the political subdivision and the local economic development agency. And they enter into contracts that say, here are the conditions for all of these incentives, including property tax exemptions. And I think we need to let them know about this proposed legislation so that they can have fair comment on it as well. Representative Striley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't agree more with Senator Cook. I think we need to look at renaissances, TIF districts, all of these gimmicks that are used that I find totally egregious, and the exemption process as a whole, as opposed to a few things, and get and putting in statute to eliminate some of this nonsense that's going on.
Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also agree wholeheartedly, but at the very least, I think we need to make it clear, instead of giving the local political subdivision leaders discretion over, you know, what they want to do with an exemption that's being abused, I think we need to make it clear that they need to take action, you know, in fairness, so it's fair to all property taxpayers across the whole political subdivision.
Thank you. Any further comments? John, do you feel you've got some additional guidance on this one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we are catching up, and the train is on time. We're going to jump.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you wanted to take comments at this point. Ms. Lichty, I think, had
a comment
on this.
Oh,
the Jamestown situation.
Please come up, Ms. Lichty.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, senators and representatives, thank you for bringing this issue to your committee. This is just one of my books. The other one is about like that. Information I've collected regarding this tax exemption that we gave a supposedly assisted living build a man who has an assisted living building in Jamestown. I was mayor at the time. His application was that he was in competition with the Heritage Center, which is an assisted living service, and they provide assisted living services to the population that we want moving to Jamestown, so that if your parents come and live there because you work there, they're going to be taken care of, or if you don't live there but they've lived there those years, that they're going to be taken care of after a certain fashion, and that there's a certain expectation that when you put your go into assisted living, when you put your parent into assisted living or whatever, that there's a certain expectation that is going to be there. And when Mr. Brown came to our council, and not only through his application, but also through his personal testimony as to what he was going to provide as in assisted living services, it was similar to the Heritage Center that is a full assisted living facility. And before I was mayor, I started building the apartment building myself, which is comparable to his. I always think it's a step up, but we have similar rents. And what I found is that he was charging similar rents as what I was, but not only that, he was not renting to people who required assisted living. And this is what brought this to this point now, and I really appreciate the help that I've had from committee members in understanding this problem. I went to the city, and they refused to do any investigation and deny the tax exemption previously given. I went to the county, and they would said, we're not going to do anything that the city doesn't want done. And then I went to the State Board of Equalization and received one sentence letter from them, that they can't do anything. And to me, it's a fairness issue. If you're presenting yourself as having a property where you are going to be providing assisted living, and you're getting a tax exemption and payment in lieu of taxes from the community to do that, then you have an obligation to provide those services. So we're at a point now is there's, what I understand is there's nothing legally that requires the city or requires the county or requires the State Board of Education to determine if that property tax exemption granted, that those people are complying with what they said they would do. So what it is now is on my units, I pay full taxes. I'm paying $803 per unit per year more in property taxes than what my competitor is. And I could have my building approved as an assisted living facility through the health department because they don't have any requirements in order to give that a license for assisted living. So it's more than a problem of a taxation. It's also, and that probably doesn't concern, or maybe it does, your committee as to what the health department is approving, because the city itself said, well, the health department approved it, so as a licensed facility, so therefore we're not going to investigate. So it's not only telling the city that this is what should be done, it's saying here is the method that you have to use in your investigation, in your documentation, and so that someone like myself, and I'm sure there's others who feel they've been aggrieved by this this exemption granted and the provisions weren't complied to. On the other hand, it's like any other contract. If I give you something, you give me in return. So that we too have the ability to go through the steps and get the problem resolved, so we do have equal taxation. My notes here, I was going to finish up with keep it local, but I don't want to get into that at all. So, but I really appreciate the work that you've done. I haven't read the memorandum. I didn't have a copy of it or the bill draft, but we need to put some teeth into the legislation so that these exemptions, granted that the people are following up on doing what they said that they would do. I would like to comment, though, on putting it before the Department of Commerce or the Economic Development Boards is because when the last time this was before the Jamestown City Council, and I've had it there three times since it's come to this committee, the local economic development director said that she didn't think that they should deny the tax exemption granted because her mother lives there and she's getting Meals on Wheels. Meals on Wheels is not assisted living. Thank you.
Ms. Lichty, I had just a couple questions, just background. What was the duration of the exemption that was granted to your competitor, and what percentage of his property taxes were abated?
Well, it was on his 35 units, on 20 of the units, he had tax exemption granted for 5 years, and payment in lieu of taxes for the next 5 years on a graduated level, I believe it is. And it was granted based on his application as to who his competitor was, and also on his personal testimony before the city council. And that is why the exemption was granted, because the Heritage Center earlier on their assisted living buildings, they receive tax exemptions. So it was, if we're doing it for one, we'll do it for another, but then you have to provide the services that similar to what the Heritage Center has provided.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Lichty?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Do we need to cover that 11:15, or are we?
Oh well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, that's the draft that I ran through, and so unless the committee would like to suggest some changes to it or other considerations.
Committee, what's the committee's wishes?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see the provisions put into the bill draft that would strengthen for the property taxpayer, but also take away the discretion of the local political subdivision to make those decisions, that if they're going to grant an exemption, that those provisions have to be carried out, or they have to pull the exemption. And then I think secondly, we ought to have a completely new bill draft to look at in this committee that would essentially take away authority of political subdivisions to grant property tax exemptions altogether.
Representative Meyer.
But with that being said, do we want the State Board of Tax Equalization to be micromanaging every single local project? A lot of the economic development, too. We don't need it out west, but I remember working a long time trying to get a factory in there that was going to make toothbrushes or something. If your local entities, I would think the people living there know which incentives need to be offered to increase your tax base. Maybe that incentive is the only thing that got that or any kind of business there. And if we take away that authority where they cannot ever do it, or they can never decide locally what business should be incentivized, we're really changing a lot of the dynamics of what we've spent 10 years trying to put into with economic development. Or did I misunderstand you?
Bear in mind, there's all kinds of different economic incentives out there, and some of them are offered and extended through these local economic development agencies who use sales tax money, and they enter into private contracts with the new business. And in those private contracts, they provide for what the consequences are if you don't continue to live up to the conditions that you promised: employment numbers, being located within the city or county. And the current bill draft that we have in front of us, I don't think impacts that, because it really relates to the political subdivision's authority to grant a property tax exemption for a specific project. And what I think I'm hearing from the witness is that the local political subdivision recognizes that maybe the taxpayer is no longer eligible for the property tax exemption for which he originally applied, and they're not doing anything about it. So if we wanted to address that specific issue, that we could do that in this bill. I think what Representative Hedlund is talking about and Representative Striley is more a bigger policy issue: should we be granting these at all for any reason? And that's open for committee discussion as well. I'll go to Representative Striley first, and then Senator Sorbuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to hear the point you just made, I think a lot of the problems with property taxes and why people are so upset about them, if you look at any of the numbers of when you grab any city, and they're exempting tens upon tens of millions, in fact, pushing 100 in some of the large ones, well, that's just reducing the tax, putting the tax burden more on less people. And I think we're seeing a little bit of crony capitalism in some of these communities where they're trying to pick winners and losers, which I just totally disagree with. And maybe I wouldn't call it radical, maybe, but just eliminating that ability altogether, I think, is probably the way to go and make everybody pay instead of just a few that are determined by a few people.
Senator Sorbach.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I first agree kind of the point you talked to Representative Myers. I think we need to look at doing something that holds them accountable. If there's an expectation, we expect these local entities to follow through. On our witness's deal, that sounds more like there needs to be another committee defining a determination of what assisted living is. But going to the second point of totally eliminating them, I think we need to be very careful, because then we're micromanaging and then we're from the state saying we know better how to run your communities than you do. And I know there's certain people that believe that, and I would disagree. There's problems, there's oversight is okay, but to just say you can't make decisions that you deem by elected officials that are beneficial to your economic development, your community, because we as a legislature don't think you know what you're doing. I think we need to be careful treading there. And yes, is there abuses? Yes, is there mistakes? Yes, to write a law to have accountability that they do what they say they're going to do. I can agree with that, but total elimination, I think, is an overreach by the legislature.
Senator Lafine and then Representative Hedlund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a lot of you know that I'm an architect, and this is really blasphemy for my business to say this, but we kind of live off of property tax and TIF relief. It's what built a lot of buildings. But I've been to a lot of the Measure 2 proponents' sort of presentations they've made, and for me personally, I don't believe a lot of what's being said is true, but there's some pieces in there that to me do make sense. And the fact that we favor some businesses over others by using people's tax money to favor them doesn't sit right with me. And I think our communities would find other ways to incentivize business if they want. I think they still have that ability within that municipality, but it'll be some other means. It won't be by taking your tax money and giving it to them.
That's a good point. Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just to further along that point a little bit, I think this is the proper avenue to have these discussions. So I think it is prudent for this committee to look at a draft that would completely get rid of the exemption. Now, that's going to bring in a lot of people to testify on the merits of exemptions, and you know that information will flow to this committee, and rightfully so, we will have the discussion, but certainly at the very least we need to make sure that we protect the property taxpayers from crony capitalism or essentially good old boys networks, and that they offer an exemption and they don't follow through and that nothing's being done about it. So I think it's important that we look at both drafts.
Yeah, you know, the biggest exemptor, property tax exemptions for all our nonprofits. In all of our four major cities, the nonprofits are the largest owners of real property that totally escape taxation. Of course, that's a constitutional issue. But I want to make sure that we're clear. We've got two different issues, and it sounds like the committee has consensus that we go forward and make some revisions to this bill draft to bring some accountability for the granting of these local property tax exemptions. But the bigger issue that everyone's talking about, we'll debate that, and if there's a motion, we'll direct John to do that. Representative Meyer and then Senator Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, this bill draft then gets rid of everything. Churches, nonprofits, the whole works.
No. The the bill draft that we're discussing, 13.0052, we're going to refine that further to authorize and maybe even direct local governing bodies to do some ongoing review of the continued status of an exempt property taxpayer. That's that issue.
But the new bill draft that was requested eliminating...
Well...
Eliminating all exemptions.
No, that, Representative Meyer, that's the committee has appears to be divided on that, so we'll do that by motion if somebody wants to do that. Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, just back to the bill draft before us, 0052. I look at the conditions here, and I believe that the city I live in, when they do offer a property tax exemption, they put in their expectations, the parameters that the developer has to meet, and they put in there what are the consequences if they do not. I don't know if every city does that. I don't know to what degree the city of Mandan has ever enforced their parameters that they've put and had consequences, or if they were successful or not. So I think it would be wise to hear some of the people that are on the ground, you know, to answer some of these questions. My guess is that passage of this bill draft would allow them to do certain things without pre-identifying them in the contractors, could be the consequence. So I would certainly like to have that question answered. I support the concept, it needs to be there, but I'm not sure we don't have it already.
Well, that's a good thought, because I know some cities will put it right in there. If it's a resolution or a motion, it'll go right into the motion that subject to continuing eligibility. So this bill might be a tool for those cities that overlook that requirement when they pass the exemption. So, Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so I can clarify for Representative Meyer, what I'm asking for is a bill draft that would take away the authority of political subdivisions to grant property tax exemptions for economic development, which is about the only thing they use property tax exemptions for. It would not affect any current exemption.
Senator Sorbach.
Mr. Chairman, I would request in that bill draft that we have a very clear and defined what economic development is, because I see that as a pretty general term. And I think that bill needs to really lay it out. And that will be part of our discussion when it comes, but what is economic development? Because we all could come up with different definitions of that, too.
Okay, before I direct, or we direct Mr. Walston to do that, I guess that, I sense the committee is divided on that, and I would want that to be in the form of a motion that we vote on, because I know there are some concerns. That's broad, sweeping legislation. We've got lots of property tax exemptions, and there certainly, in my judgment, is any harm in having a bill draft, and as legislators we all have that prerogative, but to have the committee go forward with that bill draft, I would like to see that in a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd so move.
Is there a second on that motion? Second? Representative Meyer.
Would you state it exactly, just one more time?
Well, I believe the motion of Representative Hedlund is to direct Mr. Walston to draft a bill which would eliminate all property tax exemptions that are granted for the purposes of economic development.
I think we need to refine that.
Okay.
Exemptions
exemptions become available for TIF projects, exemptions become available for Renaissance Zone projects, exemptions are available for non-expanding businesses under this chapter that the bill draft deals with. There are also exemptions that can be granted for new residential and townhouse property. And so I guess I need to know, is all that in or just some of that?
It's your motion. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that for Mr. Hedlund to define what it is that he wants to do, that this bill draft would only probably have the sections of code that would be repealed. And the easiest way to identify just exactly what the intent is to identify those sections of code that Representative Hedlund thinks should be repealed, because I think everything he's talking about, you'll find it that it's enabling legislation in code. So maybe that would be the easiest way to approach this. I understand what it is he is doing, and I'm not sure how I'll vote on it yet. I don't think I'd be too willing to go that far. I think, as I said earlier, it's an important tool for some to have, but it's being abused. I think of primary sector. I think of the ability to get a large manufacturing plant or something, for example. You know, you want to have some means of competing with other states. My only request, though, is I would like to have Mr. Walster do a memorandum on the history of property tax exemptions. When were they first put in place, and how have they changed over the years? I thought when we first went down the road, you know, maybe it was 5 years, and it had to be primary sector only. I think there's certain definitions of primary sector out there that we need to all understand. But I'd like to see some sort of history on this. I'd like to know where we're going, coming from, before we know where we're going. And maybe Representative Hedlund could sit down over lunch and identify certain sections that he wants to repeal and make that motion a lot easier for everybody. I'm sure Mr. Ralston could help him.
Representative Hedlund, do you want to clarify your motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, why don't I take Senator Cook's advice and see if I can come up with a certain section?
Okay.
I will withdraw my second.
Okay. So.
And we'll discuss it. Bring it to the next meeting.
So you're with. Okay.
All right, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Posup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment about this. I think what I'm seeing across the state of North Dakota is quite a variety of investment opportunities and investors coming into our state. Western North Dakota, the big cities and oil-producing cities, have no problem getting out-of-state investors to come in and do the economic development and building projects that are necessary to be done out there. But still, our smaller communities aren't seeing this happen to them yet, and they probably won't. And our smaller communities still need those tools to work with to build the infrastructure and build the new facilities that are required and needed for our population also. So I think at this point, I don't think I could support a proposal such as this.
Thank you. Any further comments? We don't have a motion anymore, and so we'll move on to Mr. Rauschenberger again. And this time he's not pinch hitting, he's speaking on his own, talking about reports filed by oil producing counties relating to revenues and expenditures of counties from oil and gas production tax distributions.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Rauschenberger with the Office of State Tax Commissioner. Century Code 575115 requires the Board of County Commissioners of each county that has received an allocation under the oil and gas production tax, gross production tax, shall file a report for the calendar year with the tax commissioner within 30 days after the end of each calendar year. We, the tax department, are then required to compile the reports and pass them along to legislative council. The two required reports are the county's revenue and expenditure report, and also the county's infrastructure funds available and allocations to townships and schools. Prior to the 2011 session, counties were required to report information on a September 1 through August 31st basis. This was amended during the last session to a calendar year in order to be in line with the county fiscal year, which made for easier reporting for the counties and more useful reporting. The reporting requirements were also amended to allow the counties to report a statement of revenues and expenditures, which is a report that they annually compile by law, as opposed to creating a new reporting format, which was required under the old legislation. What I'd like to do first is start with the infrastructure fund reports that you have in front of you. And we did receive infrastructure fund reports from all 17 oil producing counties. It must be noted that due to the change in reporting periods, that these reports contain 16 months of information as opposed to a normal 12 months. And that's just to catch up because of that shifting in reporting periods. Each oil producing county has the ability to receive infrastructure funds through the gross production tax distribution formula. A portion of the total county revenues, begin flowing into the infrastructure fund once total distributions to the county and political subdivisions reaches and exceeds $1 million per fiscal year. It's important to note that only 35% of total infrastructure funds are allocated, are included in this report, and are specifically for townships and schools. Township grants are to offset oil and gas development impact to township roads or other infrastructure. School grants are specifically for the repair or replacement of school district vehicles impacted by oil development. What I'd like to do first is walk through one of the counties on the first page as an example, so you can see what kind of information is available in these reports, and apply that to any other county that you're interested in looking at. On the first page, I'd like to use Bowman County, which is right in the middle, as the example. Starting at the top, you'll see that Bowman County has $2.72 million in infrastructure funds available during the reporting period. And again, this is specifically for townships and schools. If you move down the page, you'll see that 8 organized township requests were made for infrastructure fund grants. Those 8 requests totaled $789,000, of which $159,000 was actually paid during the reporting period, leaving $629,000 to be paid in any of the following reporting periods. If you move down, there were 3 unorganized townships requesting $517,000, and as you can see below that, no school funding requests were made from Bowman County. The next section is the prior period summary, which simply contains funds that were allocated and committed to projects in the prior period but were expended during the current reporting period. So that's really a carryover allocation that didn't get expended until the current reporting period. And then finally, at the bottom of the page, you can see in the summary totals at the bottom, we've totaled up all of the township and school requests and allocated amounts. Out of the 17 oil producing counties, if you flip through the report on the second page, of course, the largest oil producing counties have the most infrastructure funds available. For example, Dunn County at $1.3 million for the reporting period. McKenzie County had $4.5 million, just shy of $4.6 million available for the reporting period. On the next page, Montreal had just shy of $10 million available for townships and school grants during the reporting period. And finally, Williams County had just over $3 million available for the reporting period. And on the last page, on the far column on the right, you'll see that we have summed up the available infrastructure funds for all 17 oil-producing counties, and it totals $22.6 million for the period. 245 organized township requests remained, 4 unorganized township requests were made, and 30 school transportation requests were made. If you look through the summary report and have any questions, I would be happy to try and answer them. As you can see, there's a lot of data here for all the different counties, but we wanted to be sure that you had as much information as we could possibly provide you. And before I move on to talk about the second reporting requirement, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Rauschenberger on the first report? Why don't you go to the second one?
And Mr. Chairman, due to the volume of information that's contained in the second report, Mr. Wallstead and myself decided that copies, it would not be practical to make copies of the stack about this big. Each county was required to file with the tax department their annual revenue and expenditure report, which again is based on a calendar year, and it's a report that they generate annually. We've received the reports from all the counties, and they have been provided to legislative council.
Provided with it electronically, just so I'm clear?
Well, I'll have to...
I would be interested in having it.
I'll have to clear it with the IT gurus to make sure I don't kill the state email system if I mail this
If it's too big to be sent over email, PDF, maybe we should just, upon request of the legislator, have them get a flash drive and they can mail that.
I'll figure out some way of doing it. Okay.
We're not going to kill a tree.
No.
Further questions? Further questions for Mr. Rauschenberger?
Thank you.
Thank you. We are at our last agenda item, 11:50. Committee discussion and directives regarding further income tax credits, special assessments, corporate income taxes, the whole gamut. Even cigarette tax stamps is in that one. So this is the open it up for general discussion. Any Representative Blue?
Mr. Chairman, can I go back to property taxes? Or?
Yes, it's wide open.
Thank you. Basically, what I'm seeing here from this committee and probably the rest of the legislature is we have a problem out there with property taxes. The people of the state perceive that the state has a ton of money, and they want to see some property tax relief or some sort of tax relief. What we keep doing as a legislature, we just keep putting a band-aid on it, and we're not really addressing the real issues of the increases in property taxes, local spending, even state spending. So I just want to bring that forward that I think we need to address property taxes on a more broad spectrum, not just put a band-aid on the problem by giving some relief. I do believe we need to give some relief, but that is not the total solution to the property tax issue.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the last agenda item? Senator Lafine, do you want to hazard a guess on the UND hockey prospects?
They're playing pretty well, and they have a hot goaltender, so
okay.
They will make it to the Frozen Four.
Okay. Write that down. Any further discussion? Committee, we're not going to be meeting in April. This is late March. If you have some conflicts in May, let me know about them, and we'll try to work around them. But if there's no further agenda items, we will adjourn. Senator Cook.
Just, a couple of things for future meetings that we might want to consider. We had a discussion here today about the complexity of trailer house property taxes. Do I dare ask why? Is it because it's personal property and not real property? Is that why we treat them differently?
The motor vehicle.
Yes. Motor vehicle? I mean, does every state do it this way? Is there,
Is there a way to treat it all the same? And I suppose just trying to transition into a different way, but I wouldn't mind having some of them questions answered. And then the only other issue that I would remind this committee here that maybe we should talk about in the near future, this interim committee has always been briefed, every interim, on the streamlined sales tax project. And I can tell you that there are, I think, four pieces of congressional legislation introduced now out there that could bring, well, I'm not going to predict what Congress does, but they're out there. But the issue that this brings to states is the issue to know what it is you're going to do if for some reason Congress does pass one of them. They have had a hearing, and I think it would be wise at some point here in the near future to have Miles Glassberg just explain some of the thoughts and some of the things we might have to do should all of a sudden Quill versus North Dakota get overturned.
Okay. Any other thoughts on future agenda?